Have you ever wondered how the Soviet Union functioned? What was the official power structure? How did it work legally? How did it work in practice? Which actual bodies had power in the system? I've become very interested in this topic and I wanted to find out. And in order to give the best answer I could possibly give you in this video, I consulted a number of different books. There was this one, for example, called The Soviet System of Government by John N. Hazard, an academic study on this exact topic. There was this one, Decision Making in Soviet Politics by John Lowenhart. There was this one, which I found the best, to be honest, The Soviet Polity. If you only had to get one, this would be the one, John S. Reschuta. But then, because I suspect Cold War propaganda, Western American intelligence and so on had a vested interest to muddy and blacken the name of the Soviet Union for obvious reasons, I wanted to make sure that everything I was going to give you was neutral, that this analysis I'm about to share was truly value-free. And in order to do that, I consulted a number of pro-Stalin tanky sources, including this fascinating book, Molotov Remembers, which is a series of interviews with Molotov, who remained a committed Stalinist until his death in the mid-80s. He never repented or recanted any of the stuff that went on. This book, Khrushchev Lied, by Grover Fur, considered a classic among online tankies and so on. And there's also this book here, Stalin, History and Critique of a Black Legend. And the reason I wanted to consult all those sources is to make sure that everything I'm going to give you here is factual. So if you look up power structure of the Soviet Union online, what you'll come up with is quite a few basically baffling, labyrinthine, Byzantine diagrams that look a little bit like this. This is the official government of the USSR. Or you might come across something like this, which is the structure of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. So in this video, I'm going to try to detangle all of that to explain both how it worked de jure, that is, legally, according to the law, and how it worked de facto, that is, in actu. Practically, in real reality, how did it work? Okay. So the first thing that we have to understand is that although the West calls the Soviet Union totalitarian, it did have pretensions to democracy. In fact, the system was meant to be entirely democratic, run by the workers, by the people, for the people. And the body that was responsible for this was called the Supreme Soviet. The Supreme Soviet was the ratifier of all laws in the country. Unless the Supreme Soviet rubber stamped any piece of legislation, it could not become law. And the Supreme Soviet had about 1,500 members split across two houses. 750 in each. The one house is called the Soviet of the Union, and then the other one was called the Soviet of the Nationalities. The Soviet of the Union was supposed to represent the workers, show how truly this was a kind of people's state, and the Soviet of the Nationalities was meant to celebrate the diversity and the unity of the USSR across ethnic groups, all the different nationalities that were in there. Remember, the Soviet Union wasn't just Russia, it had SSR, so there would have been the Mongolian SSR as one example, or the Ukrainian one. And all of these different SSRs had representatives in these two houses. So the way it worked is that the Soviet of the Union, every 300,000 people in the USSR would have a deputy, that is a representative, in the Supreme Soviet. So they'd get elected by 300,000 people, and they'd go into that chamber, and there they would get to ratify laws. Now, there's no easy way of saying this. Like I said, this is all factual. This Supreme Soviet was basically a sham. When I say it was a sham, it was a front. It was a kind of... the way I'd describe it, in a way, is something like the authority of King Charles in the UK, who, let's not forget, rubber stamps every piece of legislation and appoints the Prime Minister and so on. Really, this was ceremonial. Most of the things that the Supreme Soviet did was a matter of formality. In fact, the entire process of electing these deputies in itself is quite interesting. So like I said, every 300,000 people would have one deputy. The thing is that the deputy was chosen by the Communist Party, and they ran uncontested. That is, when you got to the ballot, it wasn't like there was a choice of, you know, five different candidates to choose from. Actually, there was just one person who was ratified, already selected, pre-selected by the party. Voting in these 300,000 blocks was compulsory. That is, you had to vote. Okay? The typical votes for a deputy to the Supreme Soviet were 100%. That's right. Most of the they had one person to choose from, and most of the people who went in were confirmed with 100% of the votes, which were mandatory. So much so was this just a formality that apparently when deputies were elected to the Supreme Soviet, they would have parties and celebrations put on by the party, basically looking at it as a foregone conclusion. That is, they'd be celebrating their election before the vote had actually taken place. So you can start to see how democratic this was, okay? Now, so that is the one house, the Soviet of the Union. On the other side of things, the Soviet of the nationalities, it worked in the same way. People would still have to vote for them and confirm them, and they were still nominated exclusively by the party, and they ran uncontested. But in those cases, the selection criteria was not based on population, but on representing, you know, every SSR would get a certain a quota. I think it was 32 deputies per SSR. And then there were local regional authorities. You know, some of them will get 11, some of them will get 5, depending on how big they were. So, and what they did is that they tried to make it so that there were 750 in both houses of the Supreme Soviet, okay? Now, almost to add insult to injury, the deputies, once they got to the Supreme Soviet, basically were voting on policies that had already been pre-decided by the party. In theory, there were debates and things that went on in the Supreme Soviet, but in actuality, basically they just voted to ratify things that had already been decided by the Communist Party. There was an agenda that, in fact, the Communist Party, the Central Committee, which I'll get onto later, would meet beforehand. They'd have a meeting, almost like the Tony Blair Institute meets before Davos, in exactly the same way. The Central Committee would meet, you know, a couple of weeks before the Supreme Soviet was in session to decide all of the policies. Then it was just a matter of the Supreme Soviet going through the motions of voting on the laws. The laws were voted on by a show of hands. So if you were a deputy in there, it'd be like, right, anybody against this? Who's for this law? Everybody's put up their hands. And so every single vote that was taken in the Supreme Soviet from the entire history of the Soviet Union, that is from 1917 to 1991, there was never any votes against in the history of the Supreme Soviet. Every vote was said to be unanimous. Every vote was said to be 100% ratification of the will of the party. Who were sitting in these chambers? Who were these deputies? Well, in the one house, in the Soviet of the Union, they were just normal factory workers. Some of them would have been like local leaders, things like that. Maybe a foreman. They would have been put forward by the party in order to sit and do that job. They'd get a few extra perks. Maybe they get a slightly nicer house to live. They'd have the title, which gave them a bit of kudos at home. Another thing to think about or understand with the Supreme Soviet is that it wasn't in session all of the time. It only met once or twice a year. In Stalin's years, sometimes as little as once a year. For most of the time, it met twice a year, once in the spring and once in the autumn. And again, it was literally just going through these motions of passing whatever it is the Communist Party had decided already. They wouldn't get paid. It would be just a kind of couple of perks, a little bit of extra kudos. And this was said by Stalin himself, whose defense of the 1936 Constitution I read in preparation for this video. He was saying, well, look, in bourgeois countries like in Britain, where politicians take a wage, it's a full-time job, okay? The fact is, this Soviet Union is being run by the workers, for the workers, so they should remain workers. They shouldn't take a wage. You know, this is more properly democratic, according to Stalin. So this is how they justified it. They said, well, you know, the way we do it, this is proper democracy, and the way the West does it, well, that's bourgeois. That's a ruling class, okay? It was never really explained how the members of the Central Committee or the Politburo, which we'll get on to, had full-time jobs in, you know, just as party members. But, you know, this is the official propaganda. Now, within the Supreme Soviet, there was a position, or there was a body called the Presidium, right? The Presidium. This was a kind of slightly more elite body comprising all of the various chairs of the SSRs. And the Presidium had a chairman itself. So there was the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet. And this character was officially the head of state of the Soviet Union. For a very long time, it was a man called Mikhail Kalinin. Okay, Kalinin. For most of the time that Stalin was the general secretary, the official leader of the Soviet Union, the official head of state, the equivalent of the US president, in this country, King Charles, as I said, probably closer to King Charles than the president of America, was this chap, Kalinin. And in theory, this is the highest legal authority in the land. This is the most important person in Soviet politics. In practice, basically Kalinin had no power whatsoever. He was ceremonial. He'd give out awards. If there were medals to give out, Kalinin would be the guy to do it. They'd show him on TV all the time. Kalinin, who was an old Bolshevik, was genuinely of Russian peasant stock. He was one of the boys. He was a true show that this was a workers' party, a country run by the workers. Kalinin, when he had his, you can still see his funeral on YouTube, and you can see that Molotov here and Stalin himself personally bore his coffin at the funeral. Okay, but in practice, as I said, Kalinin had almost no decision-making power. He just rubber-stamped things, much in the same way that King Charles basically has no power in this country, okay? So that is the Supreme Soviet. Now, the actual government, the official government of the Soviet Union, derived its legitimacy and authority in theory, as you can see from this diagram, from the Supreme Soviet, and that was the Council of Ministers. Now, you know, in most countries, like you'd think of the administration of Donald Trump in America, where there's a, you know, a defense minister or a defense secretary or, you know, the secretary of state. You know, in this country, you've got the Home Office, the Foreign Office, and so on. Well, the Soviet equivalent of that was called the Council of Ministers. And this is where you had the official defense minister of the Soviet Union and the foreign minister and this body. And for example, Molotov himself, from 1939 until pretty late on, until the 50s, was the foreign minister himself of the USSR. And the chair of that body, in fact, Molotov was also the chair of the Council of Ministers in the 1930s. Stalin himself decided to take that role in the 40s. But anyway, the Council of Ministers had a chair, the chairman of the Council of Ministers. And this figure was basically analogous to the prime minister. Lenin actually held this role. Sometimes it's called the premier of the Soviet Union. But it's the equivalent of the head of the government, okay? So you've got Kalinin, or the chair of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, who's the head of state, basically the president, or the king, if you want to put it that way. And then but beneath that, you've got basically this premier, this prime minister, the chair of the Council of Ministers, who is the official head of the government, okay? And as I said, Molotov, for quite a while there, was the chair of that. Lenin held this role. And for whatever reason, I think basically due to the severity of World War II, Stalin held this role up until his death in 1953. But he only took it over in 1939. Okay, I'll explain more about why all your history books say Stalin took power in 1924. And why he was only the official head of the government from 1939 in a moment, okay? Now, this Council of Ministers actually did have more functional power than the Supreme Soviet, as we saw. You know, major power brokers like Stalin and Molotov actually sat in the Council of Ministers, okay? However, all of the policy, all of the decisions, all of the legislation, like we said, has already been decided by the Communist Party. What the Council of Ministers was tasked to do was to implement the policies, the plans, and so on, that had already been decided by the Communist Party. So they were an administrative branch, basically responsible for implementing government policy. But it's not like in other countries where the foreign minister and the defense minister may have different ideas about things, or they argued and so on. It's not really like that. All of the roles in the Council of Ministers were basically appointed by the Communist Party. There were some other kind of power roles. If you have a look on this map, there was a position called the I think it was called the All Union. It was like the All Union Trade Union or something. You'll see it there. That was, you know, one possible route into the upper echelons. Basically, in the Soviet Union, they nationalized all of the unions, and this person, this head of this All Union Union, was said to represent all of the workers, and various powers were delegated to that body. For example, let's say there was health and safety laws that came in. Well, rather than have it administered directly by the Communist Party or have it administered by the government, this all-union body, which in theory was meant to be, you know, independent or something like that, was actually responsible for overseeing it. Of course, every single person in that body was a member of the Communist Party, and the Communist Party appointed the, whoever that representative was, okay? Various important figures in Soviet history came through that, but it was kind of one route into the upper echelons, okay? But more or less, what I've described is how it worked. So, I've said the Communist Party quite a lot. But this was a massive organization in and of itself. So how did it work? So everything I'm going to explain was more or less how it worked from 1924 on. You have to understand that in the early years, in Lenin's years, from 1917 until 1924, they just had a revolution. A lot of things were in flux. A lot of things had not been formalized. So in the early years, in Lenin's years, there was a lot more arguments. There was a lot more kind of debates and things that went on. People used to still have like kind of rows as to what to do. Trotsky was on this page, Lenin on that page, Stalin on another page, Molotov on another page, etc. And, you know, they frequently disagreed. Bukharin, who's another really important figure in Soviet history, they all had different positions and they were just trying to kind of figure it out. They were bumbling along as they went on. And there were a number of like massive reality shocks that they had, including the Civil War, of course. Trotsky took control of the Red Army. Lenin was worried about the economy spiraling out of control. So they had to reintroduce managers and Western technical experts and engineers in something that was called the NEP, the New Economic Policy. So the early Lenin period, I would characterize basically as organized chaos in a way. And Lenin and Molotov, if you read this book, certainly describes those years like that. He didn't really have kind of iron-fisted control. He was constantly trying to manage and forge a path between various different factions within the Bolsheviks. And all of his decisions were basically like, look, if we don't do this, it's going to collapse. If we don't do this, it's going to collapse. Okay? But at that point, different people had different ideas. A lot of that stuff goes out the window once Stalin takes over. A lot of things are centralized. And a lot of things, a lot of the kind of scope for disagreement in the system is stripped out along the lines that I've been describing, okay? So, what is it to understand about the organization of the Communist Party? Well, first of all, the most important body that you have to consider is something called the Central Committee. Now, the Central Committee was not actually a permanent body. In fact, none of these bodies were said to be permanent. The Communist Party held congresses, typically a couple of times a year, and they're numbered. So there's the first congress, the second congress, and so on. And this congress then gives authority from what is decided by the Communist Party at these congresses. It gives temporary authority to the Central Committee to do various different things, okay? Now, the Central Committee was quite large, maybe had 80, 100 members who were said to be, you know, the highest ranking members of the Communist Party, okay? Now, in practice, obviously, 100 people is too many to be key decision makers. So there was actually a smaller body within the Central Committee, which you've probably heard of, called the Politburo. And the Politburo typically had between 8 and 10 members, and really this was the body, those 10 people, 8 to 10 people who sat in the Politburo. This is where you, like I said, in Lenin's time, there were furious debates that went on in the Politburo. In Stalin's time, you can imagine, it was much more people sitting quietly, looking at each other, you know, okay, what we're going to do, boss, okay? But the Politburo, if you watch Game of Thrones, it's like that table. It's like the, you know, with the hand of the king and all of that. The Politburo was that central body, okay? And really it was there where they decided policy, legislation, and basically planned all of the things that the government of the Soviet Union did. They handed out diktats from the Politburo and it went everywhere else, okay? So, the Politburo, I would say functionally, is the most important unit, okay? However, there were several others. There's the Org Bureau that also came, was a function of the Central Committee. a lot of the time, the members of the Org Bureau and the Politburo were basically the same. But the Org Bureau was there to allocate people and resources to different places. Okay, so if you think about the power, the organizational power of the Org Bureau, whoever sat in there was very important as well. Okay, now Stalin, he sat in the Central Committee, the Politburo, and the Org Bureau. Okay, but he also sat in a third, even more important elite body called the Secretariat. Okay, the Secretariat. Now, the Secretariat initially was basically just meant to keep minutes and, you know, to do kind of like administrative work for the Central Committee and for the Politburo. Okay, but Stalin, who, as I'm sure you're aware, was the General Secretary of the Secretariat. They also had a first secretary, a second secretary, and so on. There were various different secretaries in there. He used this role as the general secretary within the Secretariat to consolidate and centralize power in this body. Okay, so there was the Secretariat almost took over the functions of the Org Bureau. But Stalin made sure that he sat in there as well, and in the Politburo, to make the differences more or less moot across those three different bodies. Okay, and so if you think about it, the Central Committee, the organized minority was the Politburo, and even within the Politburo, there was even more organized minority in the Secretariat. Okay, that is how most of the decision power, the decision making power. Worked. Now, to complicate matters even further, each time the Communist Party had one of these congresses and appointed the Central Committee, as organized by the Secretariat of the Politburo, etc., etc., would appoint various people to different roles that were part of the official apparatus of the Communist Party. So if you, I mean, you can look this on Wikipedia, or you can pick up these books and find the same information as well. So the Central Committee, each time they met, would have all of these administrative functions underneath, okay? And these were pretty important roles, like, for example, the Department of Propaganda and Agitation, or Agitprop, as it's known, was, you know, one of these administrative roles. The editor of Pravda is another one that was appointed in this manner. And like I said, they were always said to be temporary, but in practice, a lot of these people held these positions for a very long time. They just get re-elected and re-elected and re-elected as a matter of formality. In fact, this book here says that Stalin repeatedly resigned in order just to get confirmed again, almost as a humiliation ritual, because everybody knew that there would be no question about him, you know, getting back in as General Secretary or whatever. Okay, there are some other important bodies. Famously, of course, the Soviet Union had its five-year economic plans. The body responsible for carrying out five-year plans was known as Gosplan. Okay, this was a separate body, and because it was in charge of allocating money all around the Soviet Union and in charge of the implementation of five-year plans, industrial policy and things like that, that was also a pretty important body. Okay, the reason I'm pointing this all out is because under Stalin there was iron control of all of these things. Everything was centralized. But once he's gone, as we'll see, you'll start to see various different parts of these bodies become potential power centres and rival castles in their own right, okay? And Gosplan certainly had some power. In fact, if you have a look at the history of Gosplan, there was one guy who was the finance minister for something like 30, 40 years, I think from basically the entirety of the Brezhnev, you know, from Khrushchev all the way to Gorbachev. Basically, one guy was in charge of the economy of the USSR I forget his name now, but it's kind of remarkable when you look into it. Okay, so anyway, that's Gosplan. Now, on top of that, of course, you've got the NVKD, or later on the KGB, the secret police, and the head of that obviously was a very important power position. The head of the NVKD and the Org Bureau tended to have, like, often, what I wanted to do is I wanted to see, well, how did, or like, what route into power did the various head honchos of the Soviet Union take? And I noticed that Org Bureau was a common background for KGB, head of KGB. There was Yagoda, there was Beria, there was various others. Beria being the most famous, I would say. Obviously, this was a very important power center because these people had the power to purge. They had the power to, raid people's homes. They had some hard power behind them, the secret police. So this was an important power center. Another important power center, of course, is the military, the Red Army. And generals, let's say you became a marshal of the Soviet Union, okay, obviously rose in prestige and power. Good example of this would be General Zhukov. If you've ever seen that film, The Death of Stalin, he's played by Jason Isaacs in that. He's got a cape and he's like all his medals and things. You can imagine these kind of war heroes in that time. They had a bit of swagger about them. They carried power. So the army itself, either being the defense minister or being the marshal of the Soviet Union, like Zhukov was another potential way into the upper echelons of the party. I think that's most of the major power centers covered. Now, under Stalin, like I said, all of this worked like clockwork, and basically everything was decided by him. Most of the edifice was basically a sham to hide the fact that Stalin was more or less the only guy making decisions for the entire system. Well, he would set the policy, he would set the laws, he had a tight-knit inner circle. Molotov was part of that inner circle for the longest time. And during his period, basically he consolidated power and eliminated all of the rival factions. There was something called the Left Deviation under Stalin, which was basically Trotsky and his acolytes. Anyone who was committed to the Trotskyite vision and who was against Stalin's vision of socialism in one nation was accused of left deviation. All of these figures were purged from the party from 1925 up until about 1937, 1938, literally rounded up, put on trial, exiled, assassinated, killed. Okay. The left deviation, if you're wondering, was basically people who were committed to permanent revolution and had a very expansionist foreign policy, a kind of policy of agitating and trying to create revolutions in every country. Stalin was had a different view. He was like, look, we haven't even achieved socialism in Russia yet, so we don't need to be going on about all this utopian nonsense. So Stalin actually became quite nationalistic and had this doctrine of socialism in one nation. Also became more conservative, brought back a lot more kind of, I guess, Russian chauvinism allowed it within the Soviet system. Started to select for Russians at one point. Partly this was driven by the need to get people to fight for them in the Second World War, of course. But also, making abortion more difficult, making divorce more difficult, banning homosexuality and various other things that would be considered to be quote-unquote conservative, Stalin saw as a necessity later in his reign. But Trotsky, of course, had very different views, and he needed to be purged. All of his supporters, Don't forget, Trotsky was a major power broker. He controlled the Red Army up until 1925. He had embedded Trotskyites in all of these vast, you know, smaller bodies and local bodies and organizations and unions. They were all everywhere. They needed to be rounded up. The way Stalin and Molotov justify this is to say that, well, you know, if they hadn't have done this, the, you know, the kind of Trotsky was a bit of a doomer. He was saying, like, look, this whole project's going to collapse if we don't do X, Y, and Z. Stalin vehemently disagreed with that view and came to see Trotsky and Trotskyites as a security risk for the Soviet Union and for the whole Bolshevik project as a whole. So that is why the left deviationists had to be eliminated. Then, after there was the left deviation, there was also something called the right deviation. Bukharin, who I mentioned earlier on, who was another one of those OG Bolsheviks, the original Bolsheviks, he was accused of right deviation. That is basically anything that wanted to preserve or continue the NEP, that is the New Economic Program, which basically allowed some market liberalization or some market mechanisms, not having a total planned economy. Okay, Stalin said no. Lenin always maintained that the NEP was a temporary measure. The time for the planned economy is now. We need to stop all of this right deviation. We can't have market mechanisms. That will allow the bourgeoisie back in. That will, you know, too lenient on the kulaks, who need to be eliminated as a class, yada, yada, yada. So Bukharin, who was too sympathetic to the kulaks, too much of a right deviationist, he had to go. And also all of the other people who were sympathetic to that view had to go. One such person, which kind of made me laugh reading through this, was Yagoda, the head of the NKVD, who, no, in fact, it was his successor, whose name I forget now. He was accused of being a right deviationist, okay? And this is basically, Stalin allied with the right deviationists during the purge of the Trotskyites, the left deviation. But then as soon as that was over, he was like, right, these guys are going to be a problem now. So USSR will collapse if we go too far on the right deviation. So he got rid of all of those too. Anyway, when Stalin died, as you can see in that movie, The Death of Stalin, Khrushchev held this thing called the Secret Speech, and he's denounced Stalin and all his works. Well, according to this guy, he lied about that. You can make up your own mind. But basically, there was a power vacuum, and there was a scramble, basically. And so after about 1953, when Stalin died, some of this centralization of power started to decentralize again. So it becomes interesting as to, well, where are people getting power from? Okay. One very interesting moment in Soviet history, which brings this into focus, is the attempt at coup-ing Khrushchev that occurred in 1957. Molotov himself, who was still around, who was still the foreign minister, he actually fell out of favor with Stalin temporarily, and after Stalin died, was reappointed as the foreign minister. But as I said, he always remained loyal to Stalin, committed Stalinist, okay? And him and various other people who were in the Politburo at that time didn't like the direction that Khrushchev was taking. They thought Khrushchev was both a left deviationist and a right deviationist and was basically taking the Soviet Union project off the rails with his market liberalizations on the one hand and his denunciations of Stalin on the other hand. Okay, and they formed something that has come to be known now as the Anti-Party in 1957, and they tried to ouster Khrushchev as the General Secretary of the Secretariat and basically remove him from power. And the reason that they thought they could do this is that within the Politburo, seven members of the Politburo were loyal to Stalin, including Molotov, as I said. So they had the plurality of the vote within the Politburo, 7-4. There were 11 members in there, including Khrushchev. So they had Khrushchev outvoted. And because the Politburo was the centre of power, they figured, well, we could get rid of Khrushchev. Khrushchev said, no, I'm not going to stand down. I'm not going to go. Because officially, according to the rules, the real rules, okay, this needs to be decided by the Central Committee. You know, that bigger body of 1,800 people. So then he was like, no, we have to have a vote on it in there. And if I lose in there, I'll go. And of course, he won the vote in the Central Committee and Khrushchev stayed in power. And the members of the anti-party were exiled. Molotov, for example, was sent to be the ambassador to Mongolia. You know, so demoted from the foreign minister to the ambassador of Mongolia. And then eventually in 1961, he was expelled from the Communist Party. One of the original Bolsheviks kicked out of the Communist Party. And as you can read from this book, he maintains that was a mistake, that Khrushchev was a traitor and so on and so forth, and was completely unrepentant about his actions as part of like Stalin's power structure until his death. Okay. So, what happened then? Well, and where else are there kind of power nodes within the all of these structures? Well, under Khrushchev, the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, do you remember I mentioned that was Kalinin for the longest time, who basically had no power, was a man called Leonid Brezhnev. Okay, so Brezhnev, in theory, had no power. However, Brezhnev, because this vacuum had opened up, was able to use the Supreme Soviet as sort of a kind of power and prestige center for himself, because being the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet gave Brezhnev a place in the Politburo. Also being the head of the chairman of the Council of Ministers gives you a place in the Politburo. And from that place in the Politburo, Brezhnev was basically able to organize a coup against Khrushchev. Okay, so there we have an example of somebody coming up in a slightly different way through the Supreme Soviet and basically using his position there, which was meant to be ceremonial. It was, you know, in theory, he had no power. Actually, he used it as a springboard to become the general secretary himself. Okay, and in fact, later on and during the Brezhnev era, chairman of the Presidium actually was more active in politics, so much so that towards the end of his time in power, Brezhnev saw it fit to remove the guy who was holding that seat, name escapes me now, and to become the chairman himself. You can look up the names. The Supreme Soviet, basically a puppet body, basically a facade, but actually, due to the technicality of getting the place on the Politburo, it could actually be a power center. I should mention that right at the end of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev made moves to make it more genuinely democratic. So there was actually one vote where some people voted against something, but that was right at the bitter end in 1991 anyway. Any other routes into power? Any other ones to mention? The thing to note is that over time, where the centre of power is tends to kind of vacillate depending on who the general secretary is. Obviously, the general secretary is the major power broker, but at different times and at different places, it became, you know, one. If you think about it, there's the general secretary of the Communist Party. There's the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, and then there is the chairman of the Council of Ministers. So there are three kind of major power roles within the Soviet Union. And at different times, in Lenin's time, it was being the the premier, being the head of the Council of Ministers, that was the most important role. Under Stalin, obviously the general secretary was more important, and Molotov, who was the head of the Council of Ministers, he was a powerful guy. He, you know, he had a certain sway within the Communist Party, but he was basically a henchman, a second in command, a number two of Stalin. Okay, so in that time, the Council of Ministers less important. I believe in Khrushchev's time, Khrushchev held that role as the chairman of the Council of Ministers concurrently with the general secretary, because he thought it was important. Remember, Stalin had been doing that as well. In Brezhnev's time, they opened it out a bit more, and in fact there were three guys all at the same time there who were said to have like fairly equal power. So yeah, I mean, at different times in the history of the Soviet Union, you know, there are slightly different balances of power. Don't think I've forgotten any of the major power centres. If people are really interested in this, or you've got questions, and there are like all sorts of odd and unusual questions that can come up, let me know in the comments. If there's enough questions, maybe I'll do a second video on this to answer those questions, like a kind of FAQ. I'm hoping you've learned a lot from this, and pick up a course at the academic agency, Trivium, for example, or Foundations of Research, if you want to know how I so quickly find out information like this. But most importantly of all, friends, get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.